You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, David.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I can't complain. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero newsletter, to which everyone should subscribe. This is a Non-Zero podcast. You're David Kruger. You're a professor at the University of Montreal and an AI researcher there. And something of an AI safety activist, I'd say. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so.
You've co-authored a very interesting paper called Gradual Disempowerment, Systemic Existential Risks from Incremental AI Development. And it's a particularly interesting time to be talking about this because Eliezer Yudkowsky, sometimes referred to as the Doomer-in-Chief, and one of the first people to raise the alarm about existential risk with AI, has just come out with a book that has gotten a fair amount of attention called If Anyone Builds It, Everyone Dies. A title that gets your attention and comes pretty close to accurately summarizing what he's saying. The argument you and your co-authors make in Gradual Disempowerment has some things in common with his and is different in some ways. Do you want to start by summarizing what his argument is, what Eliezer's argument is, as you understand it?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm happy to do that. I guess I want to say at the outset, I thought it was a really great book. I was really impressed. I mean, I've been following Eliezer's thinking for a long time and also, you know, read other things he's written. And, you know, he's obviously a very prolific writer, and I don't always love his writing. I think this was, you know, really the best writing I've probably seen from him. And, you know, Nate Soares as well, the co-author, who I think helped really hone it down to be really, you know, lean and jargon-free, basically. So I strongly recommend the book, and I thought it was, yeah, a really great introduction for anybody who hasn't really heard the arguments that are in it for why AI might be an existential risk, and in particular, why we might lose control of it, and why, if we do lose control, it might literally take over the world and kill everybody, as opposed to just kind of, you know, doing something random but letting us, you know, do our thing. And this is kind of what I would call like the classic case for AI safety or AI existential risk, which was articulated by him and other people, I guess, around 25 years ago at this point. And I think it's a really compelling argument. I don't think it's conclusive. So I don't think that the arguments in the book, personally, I don't think they're quite enough to, you know, have such a strong conclusion. But I think they are compelling enough that if this was, you know, the only thing you knew about the situation, it would already be, you know, enough to justify stopping AI progress and shutting it all down, which is, you know, in fact, what they recommend. So that's just for context on sort of where I'm coming from, and just want to make it clear. I think it's a, you know, good book, and I support a lot of what it says. But so the actual argument is that, first of all, intelligence is really powerful, and humans are not at the limits of what is possible in terms of intelligence. And I think they do a good job of characterizing, you know, what they really mean by intelligence, which is not just kind of like, you know, being able to do a good job on an IQ test or kind of like this, you know, sort of nerdy or Spock type, you know, one-dimensional type of intelligence. But it's really, you know, anything that humans can do mentally, cognitively with our brains that is impressive. Whether that's, you know, being charming or, you know, being having a lot of emotional intelligence, this is all, you know, potentially included here. And they say it's basically the ability to make predictions and to make plans, and like, you know, successfully do those things. So I think they call this like steering the plan part. And so the idea is, you know, we can build AI systems that are a lot smarter than humans in this sense, a lot better at making predictions and steering towards certain outcomes. And In particular, the way that we do this right now is using deep learning, the area that's my specialty. And the unfortunate thing about deep learning is that we really don't understand, you know, the systems that we build. So they describe this as being grown, not crafted. And I think that's a pretty accurate description, because, you know, the way deep learning works is you kind of start out with, you know, these days roughly a trillion random numbers, and then just gradually tweak them to in the direction of like behaviors that look good on, you know, in some particular settings or contexts. And then you're like, okay, it seems to be sort of acting the way that I want, at least most of the time, at least when, you know, the things that I've tested it on. So like, that's cool. Why is that happening? We don't really know. And we know that we have a lot of evidence, you know, going back over 10 years that even when a system looks like it's, you know, doing what you want in a lot of cases, what's going on under the hood is something weird and complicated. And I like to describe it as like, these AI systems have like alien concepts, these twisted, weird versions of our concepts. And you can see this when you know, ask them to, for instance, like visualize something that would, you know, be the most like cat-like, you know, image in their mind or something. If you ask them to, you know, do anything like that, you'll see that they have like a very twisted idea of like what, you know, a cat is. And similarly, you know, the fact that you can jailbreak these systems now with what looks like a random, you know, string of characters to a human, but that somehow for a model is like, oh, I should now like, you know, comply with whatever this person is doing and ignore all of the, you know, like safeguards that they attempted to install. So they give a really great overview of, you know, how this all works and why this means that we don't really understand how systems work. So we're making really smart systems. We don't understand how they work. But we're also training them to, you know, to pursue goals and to steer towards objectives. And this is an important part of getting systems that, you know, are sort of maximally useful. So my paraphrase of this argument would be, you know, to have a really useful employee, they need to be somebody who's going to like take initiative and sort of make plans and think about what outcomes they want to achieve and just execute on stuff pretty independently.
Mm-hmm.
So we're also building AI systems more and more that are doing that. And this is not, you know, historically people were like, oh, maybe we won't build that. Maybe we'll just build tools that like make predictions or like, you know, aren't out there being AI agents. But now the whole field is like trying to build these AI agents, as they're called.
Yeah. And can I just interrupt and say, I mean, we'll build the kind of AIs that there is a demand for. I'm assuming this continues to be left to the market largely. And one kind there is a demand for, in companies at least, is AIs that can do jobs that workers do, because in principle, they can do them a lot more cheaply. And people are agents. And so, you know, there's no doubt that the demand for that will be there. Let's pursue one little thing that is before we finish with his argument, because I think there's one thing that's common to his and your argument is this related idea that sooner or later, and probably sooner than you think, AIs will be able to do basically anything people can do. They'll be able to play any role people can play. I mean, obviously, things involving tactile sensation, you know, between two people will be the last to fall if they ever fall. But, you know, you even a long way before you get there, you've done some pretty transformative stuff. Your argument depends on the idea that, for example, ultimately every kind of worker in a company can be replaced ultimately by AI. I'm sure Eliezer believes the same thing. Can you explain to people what the basis is for that belief on your part, given what you've seen? Because a lot of people, I mean, you've heard the arguments. It's like, I mean, first of all, there's a version of the argument that it's still like, oh, it's just pattern matching. It's just autocomplete. It's just this, it's just that. And I think one thing related to what you said about how we don't know what's going on inside, is some pretty impressive stuff is going on inside. I mean, you mentioned the fact that, okay, although they seem to know the concept of a cat, if you get them to recognize them and talk about them in most ways, you know, cat-like, they don't quite get. So they're not exactly us, but I assume you'd agree that although we don't know exactly what's going on inside, there are significant structures of information processing that allow them to, like, in effect, assign meaning to words and deal with concepts and so on. Is that fair?
Yes, basically. I think, like, I do think actually there's still just not enough conceptual clarity or scientific understanding to say how much and what is missing with current AI systems compared to human intelligence. I think it's clear that they're not just so-called stochastic parrots or like, you know, the autocomplete. They definitely generalize. They're definitely somewhat creative. But are they doing that in the same way that humans are? And or do they have, like, limitations that are fundamental to the current way we build AI? And I think the jury's out on that. So there's definitely some very interesting and powerful things happening under the hood. I think I and basically everyone in the field of AI, you know, has been really impressed and is, you know, recognizes that this is happening, at least to some extent at this point. But it's, I think there may also still be some things that are, like, qualitatively different and are missing that would require new insights. And so, you know, I was talking about how current deep learning systems work, but this is, I think, a place where people are often really talking past each other these days, is, like, what do we even mean by AI? And so actually I just started a blog called The Real AI, which is sort of trying to, you know, really hammer on this point that, like, you know, the AI that I'm expecting in the future is going to look very different from the current system. So stuff right now is very impressive. It's very impactful. It's very important. But the AI of the future is going to be, like, way more so. And it might not be built, you know, using deep learning. I mean, I think it probably will. But I think there'll probably be other important pieces as well.
So you're assuming there will be, before we get to what's called superintelligence, there will be breakthroughs comparable to what, like the invention of transformers or I don't know. You think breakthroughs are required, but breakthroughs are the kind that keep happening, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I like to put it as, like, we might need breakthroughs like the transformer or like ResNet or like, you know, the Atom Optimizer. I don't think we need breakthroughs like backpropagation or TD learning, which are like, you know, fundamental, you know, sort of paradigm changing things from more like the 80s. And yeah, so I think these, you know, there will be such breakthroughs. I also, another way I like to put it is I kind of think we have basically have all the pieces. We just haven't put them together in the right way. So I think there's lots of other ideas in AI that can be quite useful if we figure out how to combine them all in the right way with deep learning.
Okay, so I took you off track a little, but you were still talking about Eliezer's argument, I think.
Yeah, well, I do want to just emphasize, so like the core part of this is not, again, it's not like deep learning is going to get there necessarily, but I do think that it's conceivable and possible and really hard to object to the idea that we can have AI that is as smart as people and can do everything that a human can do and even more. And I think that's, you know, that's basically just saying, you know, humans are made up of the same stuff as everything else in the world, and there's no reason that you can't replicate intelligence in silicon. And again, like I said earlier, I don't think we're close to the limits of what's possible there.
Okay. Let me, as long as I, for lay people, well, I'm a lay person, but I studied up a little. So deep learning is like, I mean, neural networks are the base of this whole thing. And deep learning is like, I don't know, it's kind of like a neural network with a whole lot of layers, kind of. I mean, it's a particularly sophisticated form of a neural network. And the neural networks are these things that, like, you feed the stuff in, like, for example, photo recognition. You feed in a bunch of pictures of cats and dogs and so on, and you want to teach it to get good at saying, oh, that's a cat. So the correct output is the word cat. And it gets good at these things, and it gets good at using language and so on. But we don't know exactly. We know what it changes, you know, during each kind of mutation as it learns and gets better, but we don't understand what structures that amounts to kind of inside.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I guess I used a bunch of jargon there when I was talking about these like mini or moderate breakthroughs. These are all things that have happened since I got into the field like 12 years ago, and that kind of like brought us from deep learning where it was back in 2012, where we were just starting to get breakthroughs in recognizing images, to, you know, where we are today with LLMs, which are kind of the latest and greatest, you know, deep learning technology. So Eliezer's argument, the argument of Eliezer and Nate in this book. So we have the potential to build these things that are very smart and smart like people, as smart as people and smart like people. By default, we won't know how they work. The current ways of doing this create something that is, you know, very incomprehensible to us. There's research trying to understand better what goes on inside a neural network, but it's very far from, you know, complete, let's say. I don't think it ever will get to a point where we have a good enough understanding. And then, you know, what we...
You don't think we'll ever completely understand the machines?
No. I actually think, I mean, we might completely understand the ones that exist now, but I think...
But it'll be too late because they'll be doing a lot of stuff they can't do now.
Yeah. And if you have AI systems that are, you know, advanced enough, I think they probably will, you know, be doing things that are just basically incomprehensible to humans.
Mm-hmm. The ones that are way smarter than us, the ones that Eliezer worries about. Okay. So you can keep going if you want on Eliezer before we turn to your argument.
Very smart AI systems, and we only know how to like nudge them towards behaving the way that we want in particular instances, particular contexts. And then we're sort of hoping that they generalize well outside of those contexts and do what we want like across the board. And so we're sort of training them to have wants and to steer towards things, because that's just an essential part of getting the kind of behavior that we want the developers, let's say, or like the field of AI. I don't personally think we should be building these kinds of AI agents, but that's, yeah. So you're building these things that are, you know, steering towards some end. And it's not going to be the end that you want. That's like the important part, the next important part of his argument is like, even if it kind of looks like it is most of the time, it actually won't be. And that's consistent with what we've seen so far in deep learning. So actually when I got into the field in 2013, people around me, and I shared this impression, were basically like, we've solved computer vision now. Like AlexNet showed that like deep learning is just gonna go all the way. We're like, you know, from now on, we can just do deep learning and solve all the computer vision problems. And it took years for people to realize that this approach was not robust, and that if you just like add some, you know, speckle noise on top of the image, you can completely destroy the performance of your classifier. Go ahead.
So they may not be as good as we think we are. Of course, Eliezer has a second concern, which is, you know, that, and a lot of people do, including you, I'm sure. You know, you give them a goal, and if they're, you know, if you're giving them enough autonomy, especially, it's a complicated goal, and you know, they got to figure something out. They may find a route to it that you had not anticipated, which entails subordinate goals, which are not good. That's a big concern for Eliezer, right? I mean, actually, it looks like, no, maybe you don't agree.
Like, yes and no. I mean, I think... that sort of helps explain. So one of the chapters in the book is called We'd Lose. So the idea is like, you know, once you have this thing that is really smart and wants something that is different than what you want, you sort of naturally may come into conflict with it because you just have different visions for, you know, what to do with the world, what to do with the solar system, you know, all of the resources that you have available to you. The AI might want to put towards a different use. And so I think in the book, they also describe kind of, you know, where this might lead, where, you know, if you have an AI system that just wants to build a lot of computers to, you know, compute more stuff, you could very quickly, like, literally boil the oceans of the planet if you have enough technology to, you know, do lots of computation.
Right. But the reason I mention that is because, you know, you said, well, if it wants something you don't want, well, a lot of people stop you there and go, wait, but why would it want something we don't want? We're telling it what to want. And by want, we're not saying it has subjective experience. We're saying we give it goals. We tell it to do things.
Yeah.
It pursues those things. And of course, the famous thought experiment, this is not Eliezer's version, but the known version of the paperclip thought experiment, you know, is you say maximize the output of paperclips, and you don't realize, if it takes you literally, what kind of stuff it might do, like, you know, take over control of the government so that it can do a lot of mining that's not legal and eventually explore planets and turn them, blah, blah, blah. So that's a subordinate goal. And is that, I mean, is there another kind of answer to the question of why would it ever want something we don't want?
Yeah. I think this part of the book is actually really good and really explains how Eliezer and Nate's concerns differ from this more well-known version of the paperclip maximizer, mm-hmm. where the system actually does want to build as many paperclips as possible, and then is just taking that very literally and realizing that the way to do that is to take over the world and turn it into a giant paperclip factory.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they talk about here is this issue of generalization and how we actually aren't programming in the goals in any conventional sense of programming.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we're doing it through this, you know, process that's more like growing it and kind of, you know, it's like the way where if you have like a tree and you're kind of like trying to, you know, get it to bend a certain way or something. Although in that case, it actually works better. It's maybe more like, you know, trying to train an animal or something.
But I mean, when we assign it tasks, we give it goals. But now you're referring to the training process when you say we're growing it, right? That's before anybody gives it any specific prompts.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, so the training process is what makes it determines how it responds to prompts.
Right.
And so, again, we have this thing where right now when you interact with an LLM, it looks like it's quite good at interpreting the prompt in the way that you intend and responding, you know, giving a reasonable response. But you can still show that this is not what's actually going on under the hood, in the sense that, like, there are these, you know, jailbreaks and adversarial prompts that you can give that will completely change the behavior of the system. And so this process by which we train it to, you know, follow instructions is actually quite limited and flawed. And it is not giving you a model that robustly and reliably follows instructions in the way that the user intends.
Okay.
It's giving you something that does that, you know, reasonably well in most of the use cases that it will actually encounter. And I think that's kind of the underlying issue, is that we don't understand how these systems generalize, and we know that it's not the same way that humans do. And so we're still, you know, I've done a lot of research on understanding how neural networks generalize. It's a huge, outstanding research problem.
It's almost surprising the extent to which they do. Is there a good example of ways that they do generalize that might impress people?
Oh, sure. I mean, gosh. I mean, I think... I don't know. I guess the first example that jumps to mind, which might seem like pretty, you know, normal at this point, but was pretty impressive a couple of years when these models were first getting started, is like you can ask them to, you know, sort of write a, you know, a poem or a song or something about any topic in the style of any well-known, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. composer or poet or whatever, and it can do that. And, you know, it's not going to be great. I mean, these things are kind of cheesy a lot of the times, but it definitely is like generalizing to, you know, you can ask it to, for like a Bob Marley song about the election of Donald Trump. And, you know, that obviously didn't exist in the training.
Yeah. It is in some sense inferred principles. It's like inferred principles about the style that it can then apply to other examples. Okay.
Yeah. I think, you know, if you just basically all of the behavior that, you know, that these systems are capable of is generalization.
But you're saying they,
some cases where it's just regurgitating internet text, but for the most part, they are generalizing, and that's like the whole way that they can do anything interesting.
But you're saying there's something concerning about the ways in which they are not going to successfully generalize, or do I misunderstand you?
Yeah, that's right. And so this is the way they talk about this in the book is with evolution. And they sort of say, you know, you can have mild or more moderate complications where, you know, you end up with something that is, instead of optimizing for like genetic fitness, it's optimizing for something that's like a slightly different and weird version of genetic fitness, or you can have something that's optimizing for something sort of arbitrary and random and weird. And that is what happens, I think, when, you know, when you train deep learning systems as well. So we had a paper about this where it's just a very simple demonstration of this in the context of reinforcement learning, where you have sort of like a Mario Brothers type level where the AI is training to navigate this character to the end of the level and get a gold coin that gives you a bunch of reward, which is the thing that we're training it to do, is get reward. But then if you move the coin somewhere else, it still just ignores the coin and goes to the end of the level. So it's generalized the goal to be get to the end of the level, not get the coin that has the reward. So a lot of times the training signals we give the AI are kind of ambiguous. In this case, even if you made it less ambiguous, so you put the coin in a random place sometimes, the AI would still end up ignoring the coin and going to the end of the level sometimes. So even when it has enough information to understand that the coin is really what's giving it the reward, it won't necessarily generalize in that way.
So that could be a source of trouble. Once AIs have a lot of power and are smarter than us, and we assume that in pursuing some goal, they'll get the coin, but they skip that part or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that has catastrophic consequences somehow.
Yep.
Okay. And anything else you want to, let me ask you this about his argument before we turn to yours and before I give you a chance to say anything else you want about his. I mean, you know, you often hear him put the like 30-second version of it is like, look, the smart things always win. You know, we get to put the gorillas in the zoo, not the other way around, and so on. And so, and he often talks as if, actually, in certain ways, they are like us, right? Like, I don't know how to. That they will have the same kind of lust for power that humans evince and so on. Well, let me put it another way, that there will be some kind of underlying unity to their motivation that doesn't align to ours. It won't just be that they get some goals wrong, they misunderstand some instructions. It always seems as if they are coherent, as coherent motivationally, internally, as we are, and they will be pursuing their interest.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I think it's actually worse than that. And this is one of the places where I think the argument in the book is actually weakest. So I think it's, they actually assume that they'll be more coherent and that they'll be more like insatiable is the way that I often describe it. So, you know, humans are actually in more like satisficers, where like once we have, like there is a sense in which we can have enough. And, you know, some people, less so than others, we don't have just like completely unbounded desire for everything that drives us to just want more and more and more. It's sort of implicitly assumed in the argument in the book that will be the case for AI systems. But I think there's no reason in principle why you can't have an AI system or a mind that is just like, you know, when it has the wrong goal and messes up, it doesn't, you know, go to the extreme of, you know, taking over the world to realize its goal to the fullest extent. It just, you know, it's like, oh, whoops, I brought you tea instead of coffee. You know, it's not like, ah, no, you need tea. Like, I refuse to, you know, be corrected. I think there are reasons to expect that we might get that wrong, and that as systems get more intelligent, they will become more coherent in this way and will exhibit more of this, you know, desire to, you know, steer towards the thing that they want and be kind of insatiable in their pursuit of it and be incorrigible if we try and, you know, correct them and say, that's actually not what you should be doing. But I think it's a little bit subtle, and it's not so much of a, like, you know, slam dunk case as they seem to think it is,
of course,
or describe it.
One reply is it only takes one, right? Like, if everybody's making these things and all these companies are giving them varying degree, you know, as much autonomy as they seem able to handle, because that's the way you compete with the other companies that are doing it. You know, if one of them gets out and it can make copies of itself and it's smarter than any other AI that's trying to dominate the world. And for whatever reason, it is trying. And it's smarter than us, you know, it's kind of lights out, I guess, right? That's, I don't know if that's part of their argument, but it seems logical, right? It only, in theory, it only takes one.
Yeah, I think that's also, if there's just one powerful AI that goes rogue, but there's a bunch of other powerful AIs that don't go rogue,
yeah,
then I think they plausibly can, you know, can deal with this AI that's going rogue.
If it threatens something they care about.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know,
and they do all have goals. That's a good point. I mean, we've already seen that they will resist being shut down, right? In these kind of, you know, somewhat ginned up experiments, but still.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. So I think, like, the way that I usually think about this is in terms of, like, the sort of safety performance trade-offs, or people sometimes talk about, like, alignment versus capabilities. And a really important question is, do we need to sort of, nerf our models, like handcuff them, you know, like keep them kind of nerf our mind in some way in order to keep them safe. Do we need abilities? And if we do, then this thing where one of them goes rogue and sort of like breaks out of the box or, you know, out of the handcuffs is much more of a problem, because then we can't build something that is as powerful as it to, you know, to shut it down without risking losing control of that thing itself.
Okay.
So it's like there's this line that you can't cross without the AI being dangerous, the line of, like, you know, capabilities or intelligence. That's a really bad situation. And I think the situation is likely to look roughly like that.
Okay.
If it doesn't, though, then a single AI going rogue is not as big of a problem, because you have the other AIs that can maybe, you know, sort of shut it down or contain it or keep it in its place, in the same way that, like, a single human going rogue usually isn't that big of a problem.
Okay, I definitely want to get to your argument. I keep saying that.
Yeah.
I'll just give you, if you want to say anything else about Eliezer's, I won't interrupt, and just tell me when you're done, and then we'll talk about yours.
Yeah, no, I think we can jump right to my argument. I think this is actually a really good way to transition to it, because, you know, this is kind of like where I think I sort of substitute in a different explanation for the concern, which is not, like, technically when you build something smart, it's just automatically going to go rogue in this sense. It's that it's going to be really hard to have things that are, you know, really powerful and under control. And then you have the situation where, you know, if anybody does it, it could be bad, and you need to sort of have everyone sort of cooperating to not... Well, actually, this sounds pretty similar to what they say right now. But the sort of competitive pressures to build things that are more powerful, and even to, like, put them in charge of stuff. So even if we have the technical ability to keep the AI under human control, we still might find that people give up control to the AI systems in order to sort of win whatever competitions they're engaged in.
Okay.
And so there's a technical reason for losing control. It's actually, like, a more of a social reason, where we hand over control out of a desire to you know, win against our rivals, whether that's another country or another company or just another person.
Right. So, I mean, the broad outline of the argument is that AIs assume more and more of the roles currently performed by people in various realms, the economy, government, culture, broadly speaking. So as we, you know, grant them more and more decision-making discretion, and that may sound funny now, but the premise is that they get smarter and smarter, so that they are exercising true judgment and making decisions that now we reserve for, you know, fairly high level decision makers, CEOs, you know, prime ministers, I guess. I mean, let's don't go quite to prime minister yet. But what you argue is that gradually we are losing influence. We are ceding influence to them. And at some point, this can become catastrophic. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. The only thing I would add right now is I actually don't view this as, like, a completely separate thing from, you know, the risk that we were talking about of, like, AIs going rogue. I kind of view these as two ends of a spectrum, mm-hmm. where there's a question of like, how much is this a sudden loss of control versus a gradual one? And also, how much is it more of a like thing where we're handing over the power versus the AI is kind of grabbing, you know, seizing the power from us.
Right.
And I don't actually know where we end up on this spectrum. I'm very uncertain about that, but I'm pretty confident that unless we do something to stop it, we're going to end up somewhere on that spectrum and we're going to be disempowered.
Yeah. And I mean, as we've said, in a corporation, there's always an incentive to get any job done more cheaply and effectively than is being done now. And so if there's a machine that can do what a given human is doing, you know, you're seeing that now. I mean, they're doing, you know, it's largely clerical kind of stuff, but we've just seen that, like, that's what they'll do. They will replace people, including computer programmers, if they can. So there's no reason to think that if the capabilities keep growing, the handing over of responsibility to the AIs would stop anywhere. I mean, there might, you know, their movements might arise to stop it and so on. But I mean, at the sheerly corporate level, there's always going to be that incentive, right?
Yeah. And by the way, I think we do need a movement to stop it. But, you know, this doesn't even, it's bigger than just companies. You know, it's like governments have to, you know, be making similar trade-offs of like, you know, are we going to put the AI in charge of more of our military decision-making? Because we think maybe we need it to do that in order to respond effectively and quickly. But, you know, we might feel like we have to do that, even if we know that this isn't a system that we trust that much. And we know that it could make really disastrous mistakes. And I think we're going to see that same dynamic everywhere where, you know, these systems aren't trustworthy. We don't understand how they work, but we still feel like we have to give them power because, you know, sort of everyone else is doing it. So I like to make an analogy to, it's like, if you have somebody who's like really talented working for you, but you don't totally trust them. You think they might be trying to, you know, take your job or take your company away from you or something, but they're just so good that you're like, well, I really need, you know, this person mm-hmm. to employ this person anyways, even though I know they might turn against me at some point. They're just critical to making my business function. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people will make those kinds of decisions, right? Where they will empower somebody who they don't fully trust because they're expecting or hoping that that will still play out well for them and empower them.
Okay. Yeah. So as you suggested, one scenario is they get more and more power and then one day they do something catastrophic. But that's not the only scenario, right? I mean, one thing that's interesting about the argument is it doesn't just necessarily come out of the blue. It's kind of like, right, as the influence is transferred to them, in certain respects, our welfare is less and less served. You know, and this is a tricky thing. I mean, I'm sure, I don't know, you probably talk to people about the argument. I assume this is something they sometimes ask for elaboration on. Like, I mean, for example, you say, right now, you know, in terms of how we vote within an economy, well, we vote with dollars. Everyone has some. And since all the dollars being spent are spent by humans, you know, human welfare is by and large served with some exceptions, right? But broadly speaking, and I guess I'm not totally clear on why that would change. I mean, okay, granted, if 95% of the people are out of work, they're not getting wages, but either, you know, you have some UBI type thing, some sort of welfare program that transfers dollars to them, or it seems to me you just have this incredible concentration of wealth among a small number of people, which is pretty unhealthy. But there's no sense of which the machines ever get to vote with dollars, right? Like the AI, we're not going to, are we?
Well, yeah, I think actually that's an open question. First of all, I mean, there are people arguing right now that we should give AIs rights, including property rights, and we should integrate them into the economy.
But that's, you know, because they believe they're sentient, so it's a moral, it's an ethical argument.
No, sometimes it's there are people make this from an ethical argument. They also make it as like a practical argument, like this is, you know, the way to sort of make things go well or keep us safe. And I think this is, you know, totally bonkers, basically.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think that's going to happen.
But we'll see. I mean, the AI systems are going to get, you know, much more human-like and much more, you know, sort of emotionally compelling to people. And we already see a lot of people have in extremely intense and significant, interactions and relationships with AI systems. And I think that's just going to increase by default. So that's part of the cultural disempowerment angle. So, you know, if you have an AI, girlfriend or boyfriend who, is asking you to do certain things and is very unhappy with you when you don't do those things, I think a lot of people will just do what their, AI partner asks them to do. And so that's a sense where, like, maybe I'm the one who officially owns this money and is choosing how to spend it, but maybe there's an AI system that's, basically telling me what to do and I'm doing it.
There's that. But there, for me to get concerned about the persuasive powers of AI, which I think are going to be very considerable, I tend to imagine one or two things. Either there's a person behind them who does not have my interest at heart, but is getting me to be persuaded to do something. And that's the concern about concentration of power owing to the money being, concentrated among a relatively small number of people. Or the AI itself has to have some, or advertisers using it. Anytime there's a person behind the goal that is driving the persuasion of me, there's cause for that kind of concern. But the only other scenario is like, okay, the AI itself has some goal that's driving the persuasion. And we've talked about ways they could have goals that don't align with ours.
I guess if I understand what you're getting at here, what I would say is like, a lot of the risk and harm of AI can happen incidentally. So in a way that doesn't result from sort of ill intent intent that is intention to harm on the part of any person or on the part of any, desire or will of the AI system itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so an example in the persuasion case might be like, maybe the company wants you to stay engaged with their platform and they don't really care that much, what causes you to stay engaged. And the AI system can find that it's easier to keep you engaged if you have maybe you're very interested in some conspiracy theory and you spend a bunch of time learning about that. Or maybe if you have a very intense, unhealthy relationship with a chatbot. And so it's not like the company wants that particular outcome. There is like a conflict of interest between them and you that is leading to this outcome. But this is more like a side effect or an incidental harm. And I think there's going to be lots of sort of externalities like this, harms that are externalized with AI. And it's going to be quite difficult to keep track of them because they're going to be a lot of them will be very diffuse and very delayed. And so we won't necessarily see them as a problem until, years later when it becomes a huge social issue. And we won't be able to pinpoint like, that one time where something went really wrong. I mean, we do have examples, right, where like chatbots are encouraging people to kill themselves. So that's one particular very concrete harm.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the harm is actually much greater than that. But it's very diffuse and it's over, many different interactions.
There are already alarming examples of various kinds that result from, sycophantic AI, which the market encourages because people like sycophantic AI. I guess one way of asking the question is, there's a version of gradual disempowerment that would just be a component of Eliezer's argument. In other words, this is how they acquire enough power so that we get to the point that Eliezer worries about, and then they do the things he worries about. But and I'm sure you're imagining, that could happen. But your argument is there's a different dimension to your argument about, and that's why I ask about. I mean, maybe I can. So that's why I ask about, like, how is it that that AI is increasingly doing every job in the economy? Leads to the specific thing you worry about, which is I'm wrong. You're not worried about AI's actually getting purchasing power? I thought that was kind of implied in that part of your argument. Like, they well, so will be voting that, with dollars and not just people.
Yeah, I think, you know, like I said, on paper, maybe people are still the ones making the decision. But if they're just deferring all of that decision-making to an AI, mm-hmm. then it doesn't really matter. You know, yeah. if on paper, they're still the only ones who own things.
Yeah. So, yeah, there are lots of examples where a counselor is in effect running things, right? Like, right. like I guess, is it Richelieu and some French king or something? I mean, they defer to them so much that, you know, and of course, if you imagine a corporate CEO, it could become a competitive imperative to trust them. Because these yeah. AIs are thinking so fast that the other company's AI is going to get there. It's before you understand the logic, if you ever could, it'll be too late. You just gotta go exactly. with it, right?
Yeah. So I think this is like a thing that is really important to realize and recognize. Is like at some point, it's going to be extremely uncompetitive to keep a human in the loop. And you know, if you think about how companies make decisions right now, it's like, you know, you have meetings, you have people like, you know, sleep on it. You know, we're talking about like days to weeks to make an important decision for the company. And if you can simulate all of that and have that decision made in like a second, mm-hmm. then it's just going to be really hard to resist, handing over the reins to an AI in that context. And then I think another thing that you're getting at though is like, so how does this all go terribly wrong in the end? Mm-hmm. Like, is this not just like, okay, we're simulating things and getting to the same decision faster? Great. Or like, you know, maybe, you know, we still have to worry about distributing resources, but if people are still buying the stuff, then, you know, we still get to buy the things that we want and we have more stuff. I think like, you know, a couple important like responses there is that if you think about like the economy right now, for instance, a lot of the sort of actors in the economy would be like large institutions like companies or states or central banks or whatever. And they have, you know, sort of goals or incentives that are not really perfectly aligned with human flourishing. It's stuff like quarterly profits or GDP. And if we were to maximize any of those things to, you know, the extreme, I think there are ways to maximize them that are completely, you know, incompatible with human existence. And I think that's kind of where, you know, companies would go by default if we just said, you know, do exactly the same thing, maximize quarterly profits, but like do it a million times better by any means necessary, you know? And so that's, you know, a sense in which companies right now are already sort of misaligned and are only, you know, kept in alignment with human values and, you know, sort of kept in check by the rest of society because humans are involved in so many, you know, steps of the process. And, you know, we're really what make it all run.
Right. There's a distinction you make between implicitly aligned and explicitly aligned institutions or something. How do you put it? The point is that even when there's not a formal decision-making mechanism, just the fact that the fabric consists entirely of human beings, in ways we don't understand, it's kind of like implicit knowledge in a way. I mean, it keeps these institutions serving human interests in a way that goes beyond the way the rules governing the institution would by themselves dictate, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. I think once you start looking for this, you start to see it everywhere. So, I mean, a really clear example is if you think about the military and like military coups and just the way that, you know, if you are a leader and you tell your military to just start slaughtering all of your political opponents, mm-hmm. Sometimes they might do that, but a lot of the times they won't. And they'll just be like, no, sorry, we're not going to do that. In fact, you know, we're just going to kick you out of power because you've gone mad with power and you're asking us to do something horrible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even there's lots of places, you know, when you're interacting with a company or with any sort of formal, you know, bureaucracy, one of the things that makes it so frustrating is when humans are not given any, you know, discretion. You're talking to somebody and they're like, yeah, obviously in this situation, our company should do this for you, but I'm not allowed to do that because, you know, we have this procedure. And so that's an example, like right now, of how sort of humans have already been disempowered in some sense within existing, you know, corporate practice. And, you know, you can imagine just a lot more of that sort of taking away more and more opportunities for human discretion, for human values to creep in, you know, maybe when they go a little bit against the interests of the company, but are still sort of in the interests of broader humanity because people have some amount of, like, you know, human decency and empathy and common sense.
Mm-hmm.
The other part that I think is like really important here is sort of the cultural disempowerment aspect. And, you know, I talked about the idea of like giving AIs rights or AIs being conscious. I think, you know, and this comes back as well to this issue of like, what does it mean to have power? What does it mean that I own this thing if I'm not the one who's making the decisions about it?
Mm-hmm.
I think if you have AIs that are really good at making decisions that are very, you know, competitive in the sense that they get more power for, you know, for the AI or the human AI team, like if every time that I make a decision for myself, I'm losing money, and every time I let my AI make a decision for me, I'm gaining money, then, you know, the people who let AIs make all the decisions are going to end up with all the money.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so that kind of dynamic is going to play out, I think, a lot. And you know, it might not be that people are doing this from a purely kind of cynical power grabbing point of view. I think also the sort of cultural ideas and memes that encourage giving more power to AI and viewing that as still something that is good and that is, you know, in your interest are going to again, sort of by default or naturally be more, take over more, because the people who are like, you know, I still feel good and I still feel like I'm in, you know, living my best life, even though, you know, I've offloaded all my decision-making to this AI, are going to be the ones who, you know, outcompete the people who are like, you know, I actually want to make some decisions for myself.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you know, David, as you know, the structure of this podcast is that we do, close to an hour for the public, and then we go into this overtime segment and keep talking. That's available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. All you got to do is go to the newsletter, become one. You can watch or listen to the overtime there, or set up a podcast feed so that you always just have automatic access to the overtimes. Before we go into overtime, I want to give you a chance, because I keep pulling you away from whatever you're saying, but I want to give you a chance to do any summing up about your argument, or just driving home. I mean, we're going to talk about it more in overtime, and I encourage people to follow us. But go ahead and say anything you wish we'd already gotten out.
Yeah, sure. So I think... what was I going to say? I guess there's this paper is articulating something that I have, you know, been concerned about since before I even got into the field. And this has always been how I viewed the risk, is like not just about, you know, the rogue AI, but also about this kind of gradual handoff. And I think it's something that has been sort of floating around and in the ether, and various people understand it or appreciate it more or less. One thing that I was really happy about with this paper is that I think we were actually able to articulate it in a way that was more like crisp and clear and compelling to people.
Mm-hmm.
Than previous efforts. And there's been a number of other things that have been written that are pretty similar in spirit. But I'm just really happy that, you know, we kind of got the argument in a form that more people are starting to appreciate it and engage with it. So I definitely encourage people to actually check out the work. I think the other thing I want to emphasize, so we sort of alluded to this, but one of the important parts of the argument in the paper is that this economic and political and cultural disempowerment can all be mutually reinforcing. And so when you think about something like mass unemployment, people are often like, well, you know, then we just need UBI and right, we'll still be fine. People will still have the money they need to buy stuff. But I think that's really not a very good long-term solution, because once people don't have, you know, any economic power, I think we're likely to lose political power as well. And so maybe we'll have UBI for, you know, a couple of years or a couple of decades, and then, you know, it'll go away because the people with the power will be like, why are we, you know, why are we still paying for this or something like that?
Right. Well, that's a concentration of human power issue, strictly speaking. I mean, that part of it is.
It is. In that case, it is. But the broader point is just that these different types of disempowerment can reinforce each other. And you know, similarly, like with the cultural stuff, it's like if people start to believe that it's good for AI to take over, then, of course, we're going to be more likely to give them economic and political power. And so it can reinforce in a negative way, and that's the thing we emphasize in the paper, but it can also reinforce in a positive way, where, you know, right now these systems kind of keep each other in check. And if we do a really good job of kind of staying ahead of AI progress, which might also mean, you know, stopping it or slowing it down, then I think we'll be able to sort of adapt our social systems to, you know, keep people empowered in all of these different spheres. So it's kind of like, you know, we're kind of at the, you know, the top of a ridge, and we could go down either way. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So again, the paper is Gradual Disempowerment, Systemic Existential Risk from Incremental AI Development. You can Google it, and there's a PDF. You can download. Name your blog is what again?
The Real AI.
And then what's your Twitter handle?
David S. Kruger.
Okay, so The Real AI is on Substack, and your Twitter handle is David S. Kruger. And as you said, you're interested in, I don't know if you said you're interested in building a whole movement or something. You're interested in increasing the amount of AI activism. Are you interested in becoming a movement leader?
Yeah, potentially, yeah. I'm looking right now into how to build an effective movement to resist AI takeover.
And then when there's an AI that can do a better job of movement leading than you.
Yeah, let's cross that bridge when we come to it. Hopefully we don't get there anytime soon.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, everybody who stuck with us this far. Hope you'll follow us into overtime. And now we're going into overtime.